Avery.
You want me to tell you how where I started when we went overseas and stuff?
Yes, I'll go ahead and ask your questions.
You ask your questions.
Yeah. Okay. Today is January 28th, 2008. This is Fidencio Marbella of the Melrose Park, Illinois Public Library. Also present is Heidi Krug, reference librarian here at Melrose Park. Today we'll be speaking with Mr. Joseph Bibiani. Joseph served in the United States Army from 1950 through 1951. Highest rank he achieved was as a corporal. And this interview is being conducted for the Veterans History Project at the Library of Congress. Okay, let's go ahead and get started, Joseph.
Okay.
Why don't you tell me when and where you were born, and tell me a little bit about your parents.
I was born in a little town called Donora, Pennsylvania in 1929. My parents came from Italy around 1922 and married over here. From there, we migrated. We came over here to Melrose Park, Illinois in 1949, and I've been here ever since.
Okay. Do you have any siblings?
Yeah, I have one brother and three sisters.
Okay.
My brother is deceased, but my three sisters are still alive.
Okay. And what did your parents do for a living?
My mother was just she was a housewife. Okay. My father worked in a steel mill in Pennsylvania, but times were real hard there, you know. And half the time he was laid off. It was more or less after the Depression area.
Okay.
So they did the best they could, you know, to raise us. Mm-hmm. But after my father passed away, then my mother didn't want us to go to work in the mills or nothing like that, so she brought us all out here.
Okay.
And went to work in factories and stuff.
Okay.
Because she has a brother living out here. So that's how we got out here.
Okay. Okay. You mentioned that you're in the United States Army. How did you end up joining the Army? Were you enlisted or did you get drafted?
I was drafted.
Okay. Mm-hmm. What was that like when you found out you were drafted into the U.S. Army?
Hysterical. No, it was okay. I expected it, you know.
You did?
Because the war was going pretty strong. A lot of kids were being drafted at the time, so I was just waiting for my turn. That was about it.
And this was 1950?
Yeah.
And how did your mother react to this?
Well, she was kind of sad. You know, she didn't want to see us go get in and get hurt or nothing like that. But we all went down to this drafting center in Forest Park where you had to go be interviewed. My brother and I were identical twins. And all my sisters were married at the time. So we went over to, you know, to see about being inducted. So this guy told us, he says, being identical twins and your mother is a widow, he says, only one of them has to go. Now it's up to you to choose who's going in. So my brother and I flipped a coin, and 6 weeks later I was in the Army.
Wow.
So then I went downtown to 22 Van Buren Street for an induction center and examinations, all that, you know. And from there, they took us up to Fort Sheridan, Illinois. We stayed there for about 2 weeks, indoctrination, shots, and all that stuff. Then after that, they sent us down to Fort Leonard, Missouri. I stood there for 16 weeks. I took 8 weeks of infantry training and 8 weeks of combat engineering. After that, they gave us a 30-day furlough. We came home. And then after the furlough was over, I went downtown and got on the train and went up to Fort Lewis, Washington. That's for debarkation center, where you go overseas. And we stayed up there for about 2 weeks, you know, waiting for a ship to go over. And we finally loaded up. I went over on the General H.B. Freeman, the general ship. We were on the water for about 14 days, and then we went into Yokohama, Japan. And from there, we got off Yokohama, and they put us on a train and sent us to a processing center. We traveled all night. We processed about 1 o'clock in the morning. Then from there, they put us on another train, and we went down to Sasebo. That's like on the ocean, you know. From there, it was a big steamer that the Japanese used to use for a luxury liner, but they converted it into, you know, a transport. So we got on there. We sailed all night. We woke up in the morning. We were in Busan, Korea. And then from there, we all got off, and they took us into a gigantic building like that store across the street. And we had our first breakfast over there. Well, ask any GI, and they'll tell you what they had for breakfast.
What was your first impression of Korea when you got off that boat?
I was not crying. I said, this has to be a nightmare. You know? This can't be true. So we all got off, and the clothing that we took over, they took most of the clothing away from us. They gave you only what you needed to be there, like a pair of socks we used to put in our helmet, or an extra pair of pants as underclothes and stuff, but that's all you took. What we needed mostly was socks. We liked socks over there.
Why was that?
Huh?
Why was that?
Because you did a lot of marching, see? And then your feet got, perspirated and holes. And then they took us up in the hills country. They didn't billet us in any building. They put us in foxholes to get us used to this, So they put us up there. We were up there for about a week and a half. We'd come down to eat and then back up down city. And then we went up. One night we got on two trucks. They call them like six fives, trucks.
Okay, like a deuce and a half?
Yeah, deuce and a half.
Okay.
And they took us up to the lines further up where we had to be almost like a human pack train. We have pack boards with ammunition and stuff, and we'd have to go way up to the lines and just drop it off for the artillery and the guys that were up there. That was scary, I'm telling you. And then back down again. See? So after that, we did that for about a month. Then finally, they put us on another troop transport. We went all the way up to the lines, up to Heartbreak Ridge, and they dropped us off there. And we went up. The other outfit was coming down, and we relieved them. We stood up there for roughly about 5 weeks. And it was rough up there. You got artillery barrages 3 times a day, and your kids screaming and stuff like that. Medic. But we stayed up there for about 6 weeks. And then I was lucky. The nearest I came to getting the herd was I was huddled up in a little foxhole with a punch over me, and they were throwing mortar barrages in. See? I don't know if you know what mortars are. That's like a tube, they insert the shells.
Okay.
One of them exploded about maybe from here to Cindy away from me, and then a little piece, I waited for the little piece came down to hit me right on the kneecap. My knee was swollen for about 3 days, about the size of your thumb. But all the way down, it's about 100 or 200 feet, which you come down, coming down pretty hard. So I managed to get over that. And then we got relieved. From there, we went to this outpost. It was called Yoke. I can't remember the area. I think it was a chore zone, like a punch bowl area. And then another guy's other outfit, they come up with Old Baldy. They were a black outfit, the 38th. Yeah. Then we went on this outpost there, and we stayed up this outpost for about, I think about 5 weeks. We were over there. We were just in a holding position. It was like a big valley. And then from after there, then it took us down to another area where we were guarding tungsten mines. A lot of, the 60% of your tungsten comes from Korea, but you don't know that. We stayed there for a couple of months. Then after that, we went down to another reserve area, like the picture there. And then from there, we went back and forth a couple more times. And after that, then I got, they called me up. They said, Baby Annie, load up, you're going home. And I was rotating home, That was about it.
Okay, let's go back and get some of the details of your life in the Army. Tell us a little bit about your basic training in Fort Leonard Wood.
Oh, basic training was... Yeah.
How did you end up in engineering?
Well, you have what they call an MO, your method of operation. Everybody has an MO number. And by your aptitude test, everybody... 8 weeks of basic training is compulsory. Everybody has to do that. then that, the other 8 weeks, then they switch your words where they think that you would be better off. And that's how I got in combat engineering. We took 8 weeks of that at Leonard Wood. We went out now, we did a lot of marching. We shot machine guns, we shot carbines, we shot rifles. We learned how to play with explosives and stuff like that. It was very interesting down there, you know. But so then after 16 weeks, we had a nice big party.
So what exactly does a combat engineer do?
They go out mostly with explosives and stuff like that. They build bridges. It's just like an engineer. But if you need to use explosives and stuff like that, you should do that too. Like one time we had the railroad tracks, and we had to destroy them. So we take 2 quarter pounds of TNT, cap it together, put a fuse in there, and light it, and wait for it to go up. But sometimes the fuse went out. So you just had to kind of creep up real slow and light it again. That's what you had to do. If there was any building, I think you had, like in Fort Leonard, across the Old Piney River, we built a steel construction bridge all the way across the river. Now, you have to do this in the morning, and in the afternoon, you have to tear it down. See? It's like these railroad guys, when they carry the railroad ties, and they put them on the board, that's what we had to do. And then another guy would come up with the nuts and bolts and straighten them out and all that stuff. But if we did that, it was 99 degrees weather that day. And we were sweating like dogs down there. Half of the guys were just falling in the water just to try to cool off or something. But that was part of our training there, too.
So you built the bridge in less than a day?
If we built the bridge in, let's see, it was about 7 hours. We tore it down the other 7 hours. Then we went on a lot of night training, too. You know, you went to bed at 10 o'clock. And you got up at 5. You got a half hour for breakfast. You cleaned up. And then whatever you had to do that day, you had to go down the field, you know, for rifle training, whatever you had to do, that's what you had to do. And then once, everybody has to do this. It's called an infiltration course. That's when you have to go, it's like an area like this. And they sort it down with water, real muddy, like, you know. And they put barbed wire all over it. Now the barbed wire is about this high, and they have a guy on each side shooting a machine gun across fire.
With real ammunition?
Real ammunition. What you have to do, you have to get down in a prone position like this with your rifle, and they crawl all the way through there.
In the mud?
In the mud, without getting hit. And when you got through, if they seen mud in your rifle barrel, do it again. Now, we did this twice, once in the daytime and once at night. Then when we got back on these trucks, we were all muddy. So everybody had 3 minutes to take a shower. We went to bed 5 o'clock the next morning. Sometimes these cadres, you know, they would get, I don't know, kind of teed off. They'd get mad at you, and they'll come up there and wake you up at 1 o'clock in the morning. Say, you guys don't want to sleep. Let's go for a walk. We march you for 3 miles. And then bring it back again. That was basic training.
Wow.
You'd wake up and you'd say, this can't be real, you know. It's got to be a nightmare.
So you did that for 8 weeks.
8 weeks, specialized. 16 weeks.
Okay. Oh, eight basic and then eight specialized?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, basically when you take the infiltration and all that, you know.
Okay. Okay.
I'll tell you, it separates the boys from the boys from the men. I think Every kid should do at least 1 year in the service, at least, whether he fights or not. You know, you get him off the streets and get better habits and all that stuff. That's what I think.
Okay, so when you were finished at Fort Leonard Wood, you went on to Fort Lewis in Washington State.
Washington State.
How long were you at Fort Lewis?
We stayed up there for 2 weeks. We were waiting for a ship to take us overseas. So we went to the Army barracks. They were like temporary barracks, you know. And we got our issues of clothing. We got our rifles and all that stuff. And then they put us on a bunch of buses. And then they took us down to the Navy base. And we got billeted down there. We stayed at the Navy base. We were eating in the Navy kitchens and all that stuff. Then finally the ship came in and we loaded up. There was 1,300 of us.
And you all fit on the one ship?
Yeah. Sometimes there was one ship when they had 2,300.
So what was the sea voyage like going to Japan? Had you ever been on a big ship like that before?
No, it's the first time.
Okay, so what was that like?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, they start loading by alphabet. See? They start loading from the top to the bottom. Now, if you had a Z or a D, you went way to the bottom. You had an A, you were lucky to get on top. But the officers, they had their own bag, their own staterooms and stuff, you know. And then we took off. We could still see the lights of Seattle, Washington, and guys were sicker than dogs. They were all getting nauseated and stuff. I never got sick one day going over, but we hit a lot of choppy water. You know, one night we hit a storm that was bow, bam, like that. We were sleeping on deck and they chased us down below. And I always kept a bunch of crackers on me and stuff. Kept something in your stomach. This way you wouldn't get so sick all the time. But the food was good. You know, a lot of guys, man. But coming home, there was about 1,800 of us. And the water was like silk all the way home. We sat on the main decks upstairs. We played bingo for 14 days. That's all we had to do, you know. We were running around the decks and stuff, and pool KP and stuff. And finally we came into San Francisco. We come under the San Francisco Bridge and people were throwing firecrackers down and all that stuff, you know. There was a band on the dock. Then after we got off the ship, I came home on the John Pope. That's the one that I came home on, like a three stacker. We could have made it in 9 days, but I understand they didn't have any dock space for us, so we were on 14 days again coming home. But we had a lot of fun though. It wasn't, you know, all bad. Poker games here and all that stuff, you know. Then we finally got into San Francisco, and they put us on the ferry boat. You know, take us across the bay to I think it was Pittsburgh, a little town called Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where the army base was, Camp Stoner. And we stayed there for 3 days. And after 3 days, about 60% of the guys all went home by airplane. Most of the guys were from Illinois, so we had to take a train. We were on 3 days and 2 nights, all the way into Flint, Michigan over there, you know, where they make the Kellogg and stuff. We came in over there. From there, we got a 30-day furlough, and I came home, 30 days. And after that, my record said I had to go to Camp Atterbury, Indiana, report up there. And that's where I spent the last 4 months of my duty up there. It was nice. It was about 30 miles from the city, you know, Indiana. And we had a lot. It was nice up there. I was in a company. It was only 9 of us. We were like the street department in Merrill Park. We delivered rations and picked up trash and stuff like that. They didn't know what else to do with us, you know. Oh, we stayed up there for about 4 months, and we used to come home every weekend. It was about 200, 220. There was a friend of mine that had a car, so he was good enough to, you know, we'd pay him and bring it home. But in those days now, like hitchhiking today is bad, right? But up there, they had like these bus stops, you know? You go out there and you sit in there. You weren't allowed to thump, but you would sit in there, and within a half hour, somebody would always stop and pick you up. That's how good people work to the GIs and those things. They say, wait, how far are you going? You know, Chicago? Jump in. You know, they take us all the way home. People were nice in those days. Then when I got discharged, I come home. I spent 2 weeks just bumming around. And then I worked in Chicago River Machine Company over here. And I went back to work, and I took up an apprenticeship. And then I spent the last 31 years there until they closed. And then I had other jobs where I did about 15 years in the village of Merrill's Park. I worked here for 9 years. Remember, he remembers. Yeah. He said I was a bad dude.
But great stories, though.
I spent more time downstairs for Dolores emptying that room down there.
Okay. So you were on that ship going to Japan for about 14 days, and yeah. You landed in what port? Was it the
Yokohama?
Yokohama. Mm-hmm. Now, what was it like landing in Japan? What was your first impression there?
Landing in Japan was Yokohama was a very beautiful city. Japan itself is beautiful. Oh, I forgot to tell you that when I was on this one hillside, they came and got me, and I had everybody goes on R&R after 6 months. So it took me right off the line and went down. I got on the truck. I went down to this Ripple Depot. They took a bath and changed clothes and all that stuff. And we got on a C-47, these old propeller job, two engines. And I told the guy, I said, hey, Mac, I ain't going on that. I never flew before. He said, no. The other guy called and said, you want to go to Japan? He said, you're going to fly and shoot me in the airplane. So they had like stretchers there, 20 guys on each side. And all the parachutes on stacked. I don't know if I could have used it anyway. So we went about, it was about a 4-hour trip from Busan to the Sea of Japan. And we landed in Osaka. I spent 9 days there. It was a very, very beautiful place. And I had the best time of my life. We used to go up in these cabarets, and beer was 25 cents a quart.
A quart?
Red Label Nippon. Good beer. Then we had the R&R Center. If you wanted to stay there, they had accommodations for you. You ate three meals a day. And when we first got there, I couldn't believe it because there was a tablecloth on the table. I said, this can't be real. You know, being in Korea, you don't have none of that stuff. You got these sea rations. You know, every day they bring you a box of sea rations up. You got 6 cans, like meatballs or corned beef hash and stuff like that. Then you got a can of hard crackers and jelly, and then a package of cigarettes. That was your daily ration for the day over there. You know, we got tired of that stuff. And then one time on heartbreak, I got sick, very sick. They thought I had like worms in my stomach or something. So I went up the hill. I went back to the aid station, and they sent me back to the this one aid station way in the far in the back. It was like, you know, MASH. It was like a MASH unit, but not quite like that. they thought I had something in my stomach, so they sent me to the Busan to a field hospital over there. And I stayed there for about 2 weeks. They gave me a physical and all that stuff, and gave me medicine until I was okay. And then they put me back on the truck, back to the lines up way up front. They've got in the Ripple Depot. I stayed there for a week, wait for a truck to come over and get me and all that stuff, and then they took me back up to the lines. And that was about it.
Yeah, what's you mentioned a couple of times a Ripple Depot. What is that?
A Ripple Depot is when you're, let's see, if you say you go to a hospital or something like that, and then after the hospital says that you're okay to go back to the lines, they put you on the truck, and they take it as one staging area. It's like you're not connected to anybody. You just stay in that area. It's like a convalescent place, and you wait for transportation to come over and pick you up and then take you back to your office. Okay. That's the Ripple Depot.
So it's a replacement?
The replacement center.
Okay. So you were in Japan.
Yeah.
And then you got sent to Busan in Korea from there.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about the march up from Busan to where you were actually stationed in Korea. You were driven in trucks up there?
No, they put us on these foxholes, I told you. And then
okay, right.
We would, they would put us on these deuce and a half and take us up to these ammo dumps.
Okay.
Ammunition dumps. And then we would put pack boards on our back. And, like, they give you 4 rounds of ammunition or whatever you had to take up there, or your machine gun ammunition. And then you would have to walk up to the hills. They're all mountain areas. Maybe a mile, maybe sometimes 2 miles. And this was done at nighttime. And when we went up there, they had like giant searchlights, you know, shooting up in the clouds to put like a flash down to where the enemy couldn't see you, you know, the searchlights. And then you just kept walking up and walking up. And then you bring the ammunition to where it was supposed to go. Then you came back down again. Then they put you back on the truck and took you back to the Ripple Depot.
So how many times did you have to make that trip? Do you remember?
Oh, God. We made it about 4 times. Yeah. There's an old saying where what they call you, they call you a chogi train. Chogi. Or human pack horses. Okay. Chogi train. Okay. That's real.
So then from there, you ended up on Heartbreak Ridge?
Yeah.
Now, why was it called Heartbreak Ridge? Do you know?
It was shaped like a heart, if you see it from the air. Okay. Like old Bald, there was a hill called Old Baldy. The reason they called it Old Baldy is because the artillery hit so much artillery on there that it just blasted all the trees down. Everything was leveled. And it just, from an airplane, just looked at it. Nothing. That's what they call it, Old Baldy. That was in the Chowan Reservoir, like what they call the Punch Bowl. It was like all mountains and everything was like in the valley down there. They called it the Punch Bowl. That was Old Baldy, they called that. Okay. And then we fought with the French, alongside the French. There was Koreans up there, the Rock Division, but at that time, they had no training at all, so they always got beat up all the time, you know, because they had very poor equipment and all this stuff. You know, the Americans weren't servicing them. They had to do it on their own. And then there was the Ethiopians were there, and the Greeks, and the French. And then we had a bunch of Canadian dentists, Canadians, they sent some dentists over there. And we had Australians, you know. And we had a bunch of people that were, you know, separated all over Korea. But the 8th Army had the most people there. We had over, I bet you we had over 150,000 kids there at one time in the 8th Army. And the rest of them were all groups from different countries, like the NATO, they call it. They had the same troops over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it was a true United Nations effort then?
UN, yeah. Actually, you know, like the United Nations. Okay. They call it NATO or whatever.
Right.
But we got along good with the French. We used to trade them, am I allowed to say this? We used to trade them candy for wine.
They would actually want to give up wine for candy?
Oh, sure. Candy and cigarettes, they loved them.
Okay.
We had what they didn't have, and they had what we didn't have. Okay. They used to make their own bread. Oh, it was delicious, you know, bake the bread. And then they had a red powder. And we got like a 10-gallon gas can. And we fill it up with water and take this powder and dump it in the water. And you make good wine. That was wine. So we used to pick it up, have a party with us, and we give them candy and cigarettes. That was nice over there like that. Everybody got along good. They were good fighters, too. Mm-hmm. Well, the Ethiopians were good fighters, and the Greeks. They're notorious, those guys. Man, they like to fight with these knives.
Now, what was it like for you fighting on Heartbreak Ridge?
It was scary. I mean, anybody tells you that they're not scared, they're telling you a lie, you know. There's an old saying. There's never been an atheist in a foxhole. No? Whenever shells start coming in, everybody looks up. Nobody hollers for their father. They always holler for their mother when you get hit. Okay? Then you holler, medic, medic. And these poor medics, they got to get out of their holes and just, wherever somebody's hurt, even when they got to get over and fix them up. You know, I felt sorry for these guys. And they're not allowed to carry rifles or nothing either. See, all they got is their bag. But you would have to actually experience it. I couldn't explain it to you. I mean, if you're laying in a hole and shells are, they're like we're in a foxhole here, okay? And over like 25th Avenue, there's a mortar out there, what's it? And they're shooting 81 millimeter mortars. Okay? You're laying in a hole and you hear bang, bang, bang. And you're just laying there waiting to see where they're going to hit. That's got to drive you out of your mind. Right? You're scared of the hell of it. And that's what we kids went through.
And how long were you on Heartbreak?
About 5 weeks. Three times a day, they would harass us and throw shells and just to harass you. Like lunchtime, morning, and then the evening again. And then you just have to lay there, you know. And sometimes you had to go out on patrols. At nighttime, you have to go through it in order to understand. Mm. You know, I couldn't explain it to you.
What were these night patrols like? How far away from your lines did you have to go?
Sometimes you had to go about a mile or a mile and a half. You have to sit. Sometimes they sent guys out, and they had to go out in a scouting position and just stay there all night long, you know, and watch for enemy patrols and such. And then in the morning you come back, and then you get debriefed. You have to tell them what you've seen and all that stuff. But that was all scary, I'm going to tell you. Sometimes there was a very moonlight night, or not a. We went on a patrol once where we all had to hang on to each other's shirt tails, you know, because we couldn't see nothing. And the squad leader would walk, and we'd have to follow him, and wherever he went, then we'd, you know, come back and do what he said. That's the way it was. But it wasn't all bad. We had a lot of fun, too. You know, in reserve areas, we had a lot of fun. Had parties, stuff like that.
Tell us about the parties.
We had, let's see. Every month, we got what we called a 10-in-1 ration, okay? We paid $2.50. We got a fifth of whiskey and a case of beer. Every month you got that. But if you were on the line, they would hold it back for you. See? And so when we went back there, well, we made up for that. Nice party. Then they would bring, sometimes if it was available, the cooks would bring hot meals up for you. If you were in an area where they could bring it in. But if you weren't, then you got the sea rations, that's what you got. Like Heartbreak, they couldn't bring hot food up there. And then we went down on a Coolmore area during the winter. We set up what they called an MLR line, that's the main line of resistance. There's very little fighting in the wintertime. We just went on patrols and scout, you know, stuff like that, and held our positions over there. That's practically what we did. And then we went down this area where we guarded tungsten mines. We stayed there for about a month, and we seen one old guy down there. His kid did something bad. You know, he took a stick and he just beat the hell out of that boy. So we had to go up and stop him. You know, shot around over his head, he got scared. Little boy, I don't know what he did, but man, he bam, bam. You know, man with his club. So he's funny, he stopped. You know, we went up and stopped him. I thought he was going to kill that little boy. But there are people over there, Dan, they're very, very poor, you know. They had huts. The floor was made of clay like that, see. Now over there, in wintertime, it got 20 below zero, sometimes colder. Then in December, you got the winds, see. And then underneath the house, they would build a fire. And then that's how they would sleep. You know, no thermostat. If it was cold, you put more wood in there, you know. And whatever they did for it, they never wanted money like this. That they always wanted like socks and clothing and food. I had me a little barracks boy. His name was Charlie. I called him Charlie. He was a cute little kid, about seven years old. He used to come in, Joe, I shine your shoes. Joe, bring me a pail for shaving and stuff. But every time we went to lunch, or you know, I used to take them with me, and I'd give them half of my rations. But they didn't have no money; they didn't want no money. And I'd give them some apples and oranges to take home to his mother and boy. They were delighted to get that stuff, but they didn't have nothing over there. If you gave them $100 bill, they didn't have any place to spend it. But we went to one area though. On the way down, we went on a 3-day convoy. We stopped in this one area. And they had like a bunch of stores. It was made like a orange crates and stuff like that. These people were selling us our own cigarettes for $1 a pack. For the old black market, that's what they got. Like it's right. How much, Joe? $1. What? That's our cigarette. Sorry, Joe, $1. Whatever. Whatever you wanted, they had it. They made mirrors out of stainless steel. They had razor blades. They had soap. Whatever you wanted, they had it. You know, the black market, the kids would sell it to you. Oh, man. When you were in a Ripple Dip or something like that, all the kids would come up with their goods. And they'd, you stand outside the wire, you know, they, what do you need, Joe? Little watch? Give me this? You know, like a mask?
Okay, so that part was true.
Yeah, they got black market guys. You know, every place you go to is black market. But that was the fun part down there, you know. This little boy, I was sorry to see him. He cried when I left, and I cried when I saw him leave. But there was an instance one time where some little boy in a, by a house in a little village, this place here. No. Oh, yeah, here. This little boy got shot by accident from cleaning a rifle. He killed him. He was 8 years old. And the mothers and the whole neighborhood came down, and oh, they were throwing stones at us and everything. They were, you know, very angry. And we were told to stay inside, you know, all night long and don't come out, because we feared they were going to come out, you know, with machetes and stuff. They were mad. You can't blame them. They killed their little boy. But there was an accident, though, you know. And finally, things cooled down and everything was okay again. We buried the boy. It was sad. But those things happen, you know. My job over there, I was on a 57 recoilless rifle. I had a picture of it, but my sister lost it. But see, it was a rifle. It was like a close-range artillery, and it was a rifle that you could carry on your shoulder. It was a 57 millimeter. It had an extended cartridge like this, with a warhead like this, a 57 millimeter, and it was like powder BB shots in there with a celluloid wrapping. And you could see the little holes in there, you know. So you put the shell inside the rifle, and it was a breech block to close. And then there were two oversized holes in the back, one underneath and one on the top. And when the rifle was fired, so much pressure pushed the shell out, and then you had a back blast, too, which there was no recoil to it. That's why they call it recoilless rifle.
Okay. Is that almost like a bazooka? Or
No, not really. No? A bazooka was it was a long stem like this, but you had to put the shell in the back, and you had to put two wires on it. It worked by electricity.
Okay.
Yeah. And then when you wired it up, and then you would sight everything, and you had a trigger, and then that's how you shoot it. It was just like a missile, That was called a bazooka. It was a 2.5 shell and a 3.5. Just one bigger. It was like anti-tank shell, they call them, anti-tank.
Okay.
But they didn't do too much damage to it. They were too small. They had to knock a tank out. But if you had a foxhole or something like that, like a machine gun or something, you could use that. That'd do a lot of damage.
Okay. Now, what would you use the recoilless rifle for? Was that against tanks, or?
No, that was more. That was more like you could use it in a pillbox, or you could use it as artillery. You know, you could set it up here, and then it would have ranged for about 2,400 miles, and you could, you know, if you could shoot that far with this. And then that's most important. If you were in an area, say like that building over there, if there was somebody in there, you could hide behind these railings here and put that thing on your shoulder and sight it in and knock that building out. Because there was no recoil to it.
Okay.
That's what it was like.
Okay.
Or if you had a tripod, you could shoot it off the ground or shoot it on your shoulder, one of the two.
Okay.
It's optional. Whatever target you had, or whatever you could achieve.
Now, did you have much chance to use that in combat yourself?
Yeah, we used it a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. When we were down on this MLR, my squad leader, I had an ammo bear. He used to go with me all the time. My squad leader used to give me 6 rounds a day, and he said, "Go on, pick your targets." But the thing is, when you shoot this gun off, you have a back blast. So you can't stay in one area too long, because the enemy could see that it was slow. First thing you know, you get something coming back.
Yeah. No, so after every shot, you had to move.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then after I finished it at the rounds and we went back to South Fox and everything, stayed there. Or whatever we had to do for our patrol or something like that. Then you had the full guard duty all night too. It was the two-man hole, you know, two guys in a foxhole. You had to pull 1 hour on, 1 hour off. That was all night long. But the more guys you had in your squad, the more sleep you got. Now, there was five of us in my squad, so I was guard duty 1 hour, and slept 4 hours. So it was better. Well, if you had a mortar platoon, like there's five guys in a mortar platoon, one guy on, and, you know, that's how you did it. But you had to pull guard duty all night long. And if there was, like, a disturbance out in the area up like that, you think there's something going on, you shoot what they call a flare. And that goes in the air and lights up on the way down. It illuminates the area. That's called a flare. And that's how that works.
How long would it be lit up?
The flare? Maybe about 10 seconds. Not very long. Just come down, you know, just to give you enough time to see what's in the area, and then it just goes out. But, you know, if you've seen a disturbance or something going on, that's what you call for a flare. Yeah. Or, if you're going to jump on a hill, like if you're going to attack on a hill or something like that, you usually go around the base of the hill. You set up your situation. Everybody gets in position or something like that. You've seen these movies where these guys charge up the hills. And then somebody will shoot a flare up. That means go. And everybody goes up. You try to stay as small as possible so you don't get hurt. But then sometimes there's little what they call shoe mines and stuff. It's about a quarter pound of TNT in a wooden box, just enough to tear your foot up, not enough to kill you. Just enough to tear you up. And then if you hit the top, you're lucky. You know, the enemy goes up and you go down. And then you fight back and forth. That's the way to do it over there. Okay? It was, I'll tell you, scary.
So how long were you actually in Korea?
I was there 11 months, 13 days.
Now, what was your reaction like when they told you, okay, it's time for you to leave? Did you celebrate?
Oh, I was a joke. They don't give you time to do anything. They just said, saddle up, you're going home. I don't care if you're playing ball or whatever you're doing, that's it. You go get to put your stuff together, and then a deuce and a half will come over, put you in a truck, and then take you south. Where you take you to Ripper Depot, where you wash up, you clean your clothes, you get a nice hot meal and stuff like that. And then first thing you know, they'll take you to this base over here where you wait for a ship, and then you go on the ship, and from Busan you go straight home. There's no in between. And then we come in from San Francisco, California. It was nice.
What was your reaction to seeing San Francisco?
Oh, it was beautiful. Oh, I'd seen that San Francisco Bridge. I never realized it was so high.
The Golden Gate?
Yeah. And then they were throwing flares down at us and confetti and all that. Then when we finally hit the dock, there was a big band over there, and you'll say, welcome home and all that stuff. And then they put us on the ferry boat. And then they took us across the bay. You know, I could see why nobody can swim in that bay. But, you know, all the way across, there's suction holes. They take you right down. I don't think anybody could swim across that bay. So they took us over to Camp Stoneman. We stayed there for 3 days. We went to the PX. We had shopping centers there. We had a swimming pool. We had good food over there. We went to a movie. And then after 3 days, I didn't want to leave there. They put us on a train and went down right to Grove, Michigan over there. I forget the name of that camp over there in Michigan. Where they make Kellogg.
Okay.
We went right into the camp area, got off. Right there, they stripped us down. They gave us a physical and all that stuff. And then they said, If you had anything physically wrong with you, they'd take care of you right there, you know. Otherwise, they gave you your papers and stuff, and you went home for 30 days. And after that, you looked at where you were trying to go. I was trying to go to Camp Atterbury, Indiana. And I went up there, and I stayed up there for 4 months. And then it was nice up there. But you were... Well, most of your camps are way out in the boondocks, you know. But Camp Atterbury, it was about 15 miles from Indianapolis. And you had a lot of other surrounding little towns we used to go to on the weekend. And we had a lot of fun up there. We went down to this one town called... They had two tomato factories down there. I forget the name of the little town, though. The chief of police was 81 years old, and he had one wooden leg. His squad car was an old beat-up car. I think there was maybe 600 people in the town. Ah, you kids better behave yourselves. I'll come after you. He was a nice guy, though. We used to go to this restaurant. He'd hang out over there. Never seen anything like that. That was a beautiful town. I met a nice waitress over there. We got along pretty well.
Okay, so then you got discharged in 1951?
Yeah.
You don't remember what month that was?
I believe it. Let's see. I think it was in the winter. Latter part of the winter time. Around about September or something like that. Okay. We don't know. Well, 28th of March, 1951, yeah, reserve, 28th of March I got out, 51, then I went into reserve, no, December, right after Christmas, that's right, December.
So you were in the reserves, but you never had to go back?
No, I never got recalled back, luckily.
Now, did you have any problems readjusting to civilian life after you left the Army?
The first couple of days, a couple of weeks, you know, you went around, you visited and all that stuff. I wanted to get up early all the time. My mother said, come on, go sleep late, you know, you don't have to get up. Yeah. And afterwards, you come right into the same habit all over again. You know, you go out and go to the movies and all that stuff, whatever you're going to do. It's been a lot of fun.
Do you ever keep in touch with any fellow veterans from Korea?
Yeah, one kid from New York by the name of Eddie Dynam. Yeah, I used to keep in touch with him, but the rest of them, I don't know where they're at. Then there's one from Missouri. I kept in touch with him for a while. And then we had a reunion one time. It's a big dance hall way up south of the, what do you call it? But anyway, we all, about 14 of us got together about 4 months after I got out. We had the girlfriends and their wives and all this. We had a nice steak dinner and all that stuff. And after that, everybody, you know, went their certain ways. Haven't heard too much from anybody.
Okay, well, thank you very much for sharing your memories with us.
Thank you for asking me.